Under Hill and Stone. Aragorn rolled his shoulders, trying to get his mail hauberk to rest comfortably under the tunic he wore to hide the armour. Darkness lay all around them, heavy and oppressive. A thick layer of clouds obscured the moon and the stars. Without the red weirlight Angela held in the palm of her hand, even Aragorn and the elves would have been unable to see. The air was humid, and once or twice Aragorn felt a few cold drops of rain strike his cheeks. Elva had laughed and refused when he had asked for her help. He had argued with her long and hard, but to no avail. Saphira had even intervened, flying down to the tent where the witch-child was staying, and placing her massive head just a few feet away from the girl, forcing her to look into one of Saphira's brilliant, unblinking eyes. Elva had not had the temerity to laugh then, but she remained obdurate in her refusal. Her stubbornness frustrated Aragorn. Still, he could not help but admire the strength of her character. To say no to both a rider and a dragon was no small thing. Then again, she had endured an incredible amount of pain in her short life, and the experience had hardened her to a degree rarely seen, even in the most jaded of warriors. Beside him, Arya fastened a long cloak around her neck. Aragorn wore one as well, as did Angela, and the black-haired elf, Wyrden, whom Blodgarm had chosen to accompany them. The cloaks were needed to protect them against the night chill, as well as to conceal their weapons from anyone they might encounter in the city, if they got that far. Nasawada, Jormunda, and Saphira had accompanied them to the edge of the camp, where they now stood. Among the tents, the men of the Varden, dwarves, and Urgles were busy preparing to march forth. "Don't forget," said Nasawada, her breath steaming in front of her. "If you can't reach the gates by dawn, find somewhere to wait until tomorrow morning, and we'll try again then." "We may not have the luxury of waiting," said Arya. Nasawada rubbed her arms and nodded. She appeared unusually worried. "I know. Either way, we'll be ready to attack as soon as you contact us, no matter the time of day. Your safety is more important than capturing Drasleona, remember that." Her gaze drifted toward Aragorn as she spoke. "We should be off," said Wyrden. "The night grows old." Aragorn pressed his forehead against Saphira for a moment.
"Good hunting," she said softly.
"And you as well."
They reluctantly parted, and Aragorn joined Arya and Wyrden as they followed Angela away from the camp, heading toward the eastern edge of the city. Nasawada and Jormunda murmured well wishes and farewells as they strode past, and then all was quiet, save the sounds of their breathing and of their boots on the ground. Angela dimmed the light in her palm until it was barely bright enough for Aragorn to see his feet. He had to strain his eyes to spot rocks and branches that lay in the way. They walked in silence for nearly an hour, at which point the herbalist stopped and whispered,
"We're here, as best I can tell. I'm fairly good at reckoning distances, but we might be off by more than 1,000 feet. It's hard to be certain of anything in this gloom."
Off to their left, a half-dozen pinpricks of light floated above the horizon, the only evidence that they were anywhere near Drasleona. The light seemed close enough to pluck from the air. He and the two women gathered around Wyrden as the elf knelt and pulled the glove off his right hand, placing his palm against the bare earth. Wyrden began to croon the spell he had learned from the dwarven magician, whom ere they left on their mission, Auric had sent to instruct them in the ways of detecting underground chambers. While the elf sang, Aragorn stared into the surrounding blackness, listening and watching for enemies. The fall of raindrops on his face increased. He hoped the weather would improve before battle was joined, if battle was to be joined. An owl hooted somewhere, and he reached for Brisinga, only to stop himself and clench his fist.
"Basul,"
he said to himself, using Auric's favourite curse. He was more nervous than he ought to be. The knowledge that he might be about to fight Murtagh and Thorn again, singly or together, had put him on edge.
"I'll be sure to lose if I keep on like this," he thought.
So he slowed his breathing and initiated the first of the mental exercises Gleda had taught him for establishing control over his emotions. The old dragon had not been enthusiastic about the mission when Aragorn told him about it, but neither had he opposed it. After discussing various contingencies, Glader had said,
"Beware of the shadows, Aragorn. Strange things lurk in dark places."
Which Aragorn thought was hardly an encouraging statement. He wiped the accumulated moisture off his face, keeping his other hand close to the hilt of his sword. The leather of his glove was warm and smooth against his skin. Lowering his hand, he hooked his thumb under his sword belt, the belt of Beloth the Wise, conscious of the weight of the 12 flawless diamonds concealed within. That morning he had gone to the livestock pens, and as the cooks killed the birds and sheep for the army's breakfast, he had transferred the dying animal's energy into the gems. He hated doing so. When he reached out with his mind to an animal, if it still had its head attached, the animal's fear and pain became his own, and as it slipped into the void he felt as if he himself were dying. It was a horrible, panic-inducing experience. Whenever he could, he had whispered words in the ancient language to the animals in an attempt to comfort them. Sometimes it worked, sometimes not. Though the creatures would have died in any case, and though he needed the energy, he hated the practice, for it made him feel as if he were responsible for their deaths. It made him feel unclean. Now he fancied that the belt was slightly heavier than before, laden as it was with the energy from so many animals. Even if the diamonds within had been worthless, Aragorn would have regarded the belt as valuable beyond gold, on account of the dozens of lives that had gone into filling it. As Wirden ceased singing, Arya asked, "Have you found it?" "This way," said Wirden, standing. Relief and trepidation swept through Aragorn. Jode was right. Wirden led them over a road and a series of small hills, then down into a shallow wash hidden within the folds of the land. "The mouth of the tunnel should be somewhere here," said the elf, and gestured at the western bank of the depression. The herbalist increased the brightness of her weirlight enough for them to search by. Then Aragorn, Arya, and Wirden began to comb through the brush along the side of the bank, poking at the ground with sticks. Twice Aragorn barked his shins against the stumps of fallen birch trees, causing him to suck in his breath with pain. He wished he was wearing braces, but he had left them behind along with his shield, because they would have attracted too much attention in the city. For 20 minutes they searched, ranging up and down the bank as they worked their way out from their starting point. At last Aragorn heard a ring of metal, and then Arya softly called, "Here!" He and the others hurried toward her, where she stood by a small overgrown hollow in the side of the bank. Arya drew aside the brush to reveal a stone-lined tunnel, 5 feet tall and 3 feet wide. A rusting iron grate covered the gaping hole. "Look," Arya said, and she pointed at the ground. Aragorn looked, and he saw a path leading out of the tunnel. Even by the weird red illumination of the herbalist's weirlight, Aragorn could tell that the trail had been worn into place by the passage of tramping feet. One or more people must have been using the tunnel to surreptitiously enter and exit Drasleona. "We should proceed with caution," whispered Wirden. Angela made a faint noise in her throat. "How else were you planning to proceed? With blaring trumpets and shouting heralds? Really?" The elf refrained from answering, but he appeared distinctly uncomfortable. Arya and Wirden pulled off the grating and cautiously moved into the tunnel. Both conjured weirlights of their own. The flameless orbs floated over their heads like small red suns, though they admitted no more light than a handful of coals. Aragorn hung back and said to Angela, "Why do the elves treat you so respectfully? They seem almost afraid of you. Am I not deserving of respect?" He hesitated. "One of these days, you know, you're going to have to tell me about yourself." "What makes you think that?" And she pushed past him to enter the tunnel, her cloak flapping like the wings of a leatherblacker. Shaking his head, Aragorn followed. The short herbalist did not have to bend much in order to avoid bumping into the ceiling, but Aragorn had to hunch like an old man with rheumatism, as did the two elves. For the most part, the tunnel was empty. A fine layer of caked dirt covered the floor. A few sticks and rocks and even a discarded snakeskin were scattered near the mouth of the tunnel. The passageway smelled like damp straw and moth wings. Aragorn and the others walked as quietly as they could, but the tunnel magnified sounds. Every bump and scrape echoed, filling the air with a multitude of overlapping whispers that seemed to murmur and sigh with a life of their own. The whispers made Aragorn feel as if they were surrounded by a host of disembodied spirits who were commenting on their every move. "So much for sneaking up on anyone," he thought, as he scuffed his boot against a rock, which bounced against the side of the tunnel with a loud clack that multiplied 100-fold as it spread through the tunnel. "Sorry," he mouthed, as everyone looked at him. A wry smile touched his lips. "At least we know what causes the strange sounds underneath Drasliona. He would have to tell Jode on their return." When they had gone a fair ways down the tunnel, Aragorn paused and looked back at the entrance, which was already lost in darkness. The gloom seemed almost palpable, like a heavy cloth draped over the world. Combined with the close-set walls and low ceiling, it left him feeling cramped and constricted. Normally he did not mind being in enclosed places, but the tunnel reminded him of the warren of rough-hewn passageways within Helgrind, where he and Rohan had fought the Razak. Hardly a pleasant memory. He took a deep breath, then released it. Just as he was about to continue forward, he caught a glimpse of two large eyes gleaming in the shadows, like a pair of copper-coloured moonstones. He grabbed Brisinga and had already drawn the sword several inches from its scabbard when Solemnbum appeared out of the murk, padding along on silent paws. The weercat stopped at the edge of the light. He twitched his black-tipped ears, and his jaws parted in what seemed to be an expression of amusement. Aragorn relaxed and acknowledged the weercat's presence with a dip of his head. "I should have guessed." Wherever Angela went, Solemnbum invariably followed. Again, Aragorn wondered about the herbalist's past. How did she ever win his loyalty? As the rest of the party grew distant, the shadows crept over Solemnbum once more, hiding him from Aragorn's sight. Comforted by the knowledge that the weercat was watching his back, Aragorn hurried to catch up. Before the group left the camp, Nasawada had briefed them on the exact number of soldiers in the city, as well as where they were stationed and their duties and habits. She had also given them details about Murtagh's sleeping quarters, what he ate, and even his mood the previous evening. Her information had been remarkably precise. When questioned, she had smiled and explained that since the Varden had arrived, the weercats had been spying for her within Drasliona. Once Aragorn and his companions emerged within the city, the weercats would escort them to the southern gates, but would not reveal their own presence to the Empire if at all possible, else they would no longer be able to supply Nasawada with intelligence as effectively. After all, who would suspect that the unusually large cat lounging nearby was actually an enemy spy? It occurred to Aragorn then, as he reviewed Nasawada's briefing, that one of Murtagh's greatest weaknesses was that he still had to sleep. "If we don't capture or kill him today, the next time we meet, it might help us to find a way to wake him in the middle of the night, and for more nights than one if we could manage it. 3 or 4 days without proper sleep, and he'd be in no fit shape to fight." On and on they went through the tunnel, which ran straight as an arrow, never bending, never turning. Aragorn thought he detected a slight upward slant to the floor, which would make sense, as it was designed to channel waste out of the city, but he was not entirely sure. After a while, the dirt beneath their feet began to soften and stick to their boots like wet clay. Water dripped from the ceiling, sometimes landing on the nape of Aragorn's neck and rolling down his spine, like the touch of a cold finger. He slipped once on a patch of mud, and when he put out a hand for balance, found the wall covered in slime. An indeterminate amount of time passed. They might have spent an hour in the tunnel, they might have spent 10, or maybe it was only a few minutes. Whatever the case, Aragorn's neck and shoulders hurt from standing half bent over, and he grew tired of staring at what seemed to be the same 20 feet of rose-hued stone. At last he noticed the echoes were waning, and ever more of a delay was appearing between each repetition of the sounds. Soon afterward, the tunnel disgorged them into a large rectangular chamber, with a ridged half-domed ceiling over 15 feet high at its apex. The chamber was empty, except for a rotting barrel in one corner. Across from them, three identical archways opened to three identical rooms, small and dark. Where those led, Aragorn could not see. The group stopped, and Aragorn slowly straightened his back, wincing as his sore muscles stretched.
"This would not have been part of Erst Greybeard's plans," said Arya.
"Which path should we pick?" asked Wirden.
"Isn't it obvious?" asked the herbalist. "The left one. It's always the left one."
And she strode toward that selfsame arch, even as she spoke. Aragorn could not help himself.
"Left according to which direction? If you were starting from the other side, left..."
"Left would be right, and right would be left, yes, yes," said the herbalist. Her eyes narrowed.
"Sometimes you're too clever for your own good, Shadeslayer. Very well, we'll try it your way. But don't say I didn't warn you if we end up wandering around here for days on end."
Aragorn would actually have preferred to take the centre archway, as it seemed the most likely to lead them up to the streets, but he did not want to get into an argument with the herbalist.
"Either way, we'll find stairs soon enough," he thought. "There can't be that many chambers under Drasleona."
Holding her wheelite aloft, Angela took the lead. Wirden and Arya followed, while Aragorn brought up the rear. The room through the rightmost archway was larger than it had first appeared, for it extended to the side for 20 feet, then turned and continued for another few yards, whereupon it ended at a corridor studded with empty sconces. Down the corridor was another small room lined with three arches, each of which led to rooms with even more archways, and so on.
"Who built these, and why?" Aragorn wondered, bewildered.
All the rooms they saw were deserted and empty of furnishings. The only things they found within were a two-legged stool that fell apart when he nudged it with the tip of his boot, and a pile of broken pottery lying in a corner beneath a veil of spiderwebs. Angela never hesitated or seemed confused about which direction to go, but without fail she chose the path to the right. Aragorn would have objected, except that he could think of no better alternative to her method. The herbalist stopped when they arrived at a circular room with seven equally spaced archways placed along the walls. Seven corridors, including the one they had just traversed, stretched out from the archways.
"Mark where we come from, or we'll get completely turned around," said Arya.
Aragorn went to the corridor, and with the tip of Brisinger's crossguard, scratched a line on the stone wall. As he did, he peered into the darkness, searching for a glimpse of Solombum, but he saw not so much as a whisker. Aragorn hoped the Weircat had not gotten lost somewhere in the maze of rooms. He almost reached out with his mind to find him, but resisted the urge. If anyone else felt him groping around, it might alert the Empire to their location.
"Ah!"
exclaimed Angela, and the shadows around Aragorn shifted, as the herbalist stood on tiptoe and raised her wheelite as high as she could. Aragorn hurried to the centre of the room, where she stood with Arya and Wirden.
"What is it?"
he whispered.
"The ceiling, Aragorn," murmured Arya. "Look at the ceiling."
He did as he was told, but saw only blocks of ancient mould-covered stones, crazed with so many cracks. It seemed amazing the ceiling had not collapsed long ago. Then his vision shifted, and he gasped. The lines were not cracks, but rather deeply carved runes, rows of them. They were neat and small, with sharp angles and straight stems. Mould and the passage of centuries had obscured parts of the text, but most of it remained legible. Aragorn struggled with the runes for a short while, but he recognized only a few of the words, and those were spelled differently than he was used to.
"What does it say?" he asked. "Is it dwarvish?"
"No," said Wirden.
"It is the language of your people, but as it was spoken and written long ago, and of a very particular dialect, that of the zealot Tosk."
The name struck a chord in Aragorn. "When Roran and I rescued Katrina, we heard the priests of Helgrind mention a book of Tosk." Wirden nodded.
"It serves as the foundation of their faith.
Tosk was not the first to offer up prayers to Helgrind, but he was the first to codify his beliefs and practices, and many others have imitated him since. Those who worship Helgrind regard him as a prophet of the divine. And this, the elf cast his arms out wide, is a history of Tosk, from his birth to his death. A true history, such as his disciples have never shared with those outside their sect. We could learn much from this, said Angela, never taking her eyes off the ceiling. If only we had the time. Aragorn was surprised to see her so enthralled. Arya glanced at the seven corridors. A moment then, but read quickly. While Angela and Wirden perused the runes with avid intensity, Arya walked over to one of the archways and in an undertone began to chant a spell for finding and locating. When she finished, she waited a moment with her head cocked, then moved on to the next archway. Aragorn stared at the runes a bit longer. Then he returned to the mouth of the corridor that had brought them to the room and leaned against the wall while he waited. The cold of the stones seeped into his shoulder. Arya stopped in front of the fourth archway. The now familiar cadence of her recitation rose and fell like a soft sigh of wind. Again, nothing. A faint tickling on the back of his right hand caused Aragorn to look down. A huge wingless cricket clung to his glove. The insect was hideous, black and bulbous, with barbed legs and a massive skull-like head. Its carapace gleamed like oil. Aragorn shuddered, his skin crawling, and shook his arm, flinging the cricket into the darkness. It landed with an audible thump. The fifth corridor proved no more fruitful for Arya than the preceding four. She bypassed the opening where Aragorn stood and stationed herself in front of the seventh archway. Before she could cast her spell, a guttural yowl echoed down the corridors, seemingly from all directions at once. Then there was a hiss and a spat and a screech that made every hair on Aragorn's body stand on end. Angela whirled around. Solimbum! As one, the four of them drew their blades. Aragorn backed into the center of the room, his gaze darting from one archway to the next. His Gedwe Ignazia itched and tingled like a flea bite, a useless warning, for it did not tell him where or what the danger was. This way, said Arya, moving toward the seventh archway. The herbalist refused to budge. No, she whispered vehemently. We have to help him. Aragorn noticed that she held a short sword with a strange, colourless blade that flashed gem-like in the light. Arya scowled. If Murtagh learns we're here, we'll... It happened so quickly and silently, Aragorn would never have noticed had he not been looking in the right direction. A half-dozen doors, hidden within the walls of three different corridors, swung open, and 30 or so black-garbed men ran out toward them, swords in hand. Let her! Shouted Wirden, and the men in one group collided with each other as if those in front had run headlong into a wall. Then the rest of the attackers fell upon them, and there was no time for magic. Aragorn easily parried a stab and with a looping backhanded stroke sliced off the attacker's head. Like all the others, the man wore a kerchief tied over his face so only his eyes were exposed, and the kerchief fluttered as the head fell spinning toward the floor. Aragorn was relieved when he felt Brisinga sink into flesh and blood. For a moment he had feared that their opponents were protected by spells or armor, or worse, that they were something other than human. He skewered another man through the ribs and had just turned to deal with two more of his attackers when a sword that should not have been there arced through the air toward his throat. His wards saved him from certain death, yet with the blade an inch away from his neck, Aragorn could not help but stumble back. To his astonishment, the man he had stabbed was still standing, blood streaming down his side, seemingly oblivious to the hole Aragorn had poked through him. Dread settled over Aragorn. They can't feel pain, he shouted, even as he frantically blocked swords from three different directions. If anyone heard him, they failed to respond. He wasted no more time talking, but concentrated on fighting the men in front of him, trusting his companions to protect his back. Aragorn lunged and parried and dodged, whipping Brisinga through the air as if it weighed no more than a switch.
Ordinarily, he could have killed any of the men in an instant, but the fact that they were impervious to pain meant that he had to either behead them, stab them through the heart, or cut them and hold them off until loss of blood rendered them unconscious. Otherwise, the attackers kept trying to kill him, regardless of their injuries. The number of men made it difficult to evade all of their blows and strike back in return. He could have stopped defending himself and just let his wards protect him, but that would tire him just as quickly as springing Brisinger. And since he could not predict exactly when his wards would fail, as they must at a certain point, else they would kill him, and he knew he might need them later on, he fought just as carefully and cautiously as if he were facing men whose swords could kill or maim with a single stroke. More black-garbed warriors streamed out of the hidden doorways within the corridors. They crowded around Aragorn, pushing him back through sheer weight of numbers. Hands clung to his legs and arms, threatening to immobilize him. "Kvaerst!" he growled under his breath, uttering one of the 12 death words Oromis had taught him. As he had suspected, his spell had no effect. The men were warded against direct magical attacks. He quickly readied a spell Murtagh had once used on him. Thrista Vinder. It was a roundabout way of striking at the men, as he was not actually hitting them, but rather pushing the air against them. In any case, it worked. A howl of wind filled the chamber, clawing at Aragorn's hair and cloak, and sending the men closest to him, flying back into their compatriots, clearing a space of 10 feet in front of him. His strength decreased commensurately, but not enough to incapacitate him. He turned to see how the others were doing. He had not been the first to find a way to circumvent the men's wards. Bolts of lightning extended from Wirden's right arm and wrapped themselves around any warrior unfortunate enough to pass in front of him. The glowing cables of energy appeared almost liquid as they writhed around their victims. Still more men were forcing their way into the room, however. "This way!" cried Arya, and sprang toward the 7th corridor, the one she had failed to examine before the ambush. Wirden followed, as did Aragorn. Angela brought up the rear, limping and clutching at a bloody cut on her shoulder. Behind them, the black-garbed men hesitated, milling in the chamber for a moment. Then with a mighty roar, they gave chase. As he sprinted down the corridor, Aragorn strove to compose a variation of his earlier spell that would allow him to kill the men instead of just knocking them away. He quickly devised one and held it in readiness to use as soon as he could see a fair number of the attackers. "Who are they?" he wondered. "How many of them are there?" Up ahead, he glimpsed an opening through which shone a faint, purplish light. He just had time to feel apprehensive about its source before the herbalist uttered a loud cry, and there was a dull orange flash and a teeth-jarring thud, and the smell of sulphur filled the air. Aragorn whirled around to see 5 men dragging the herbalist through a doorway that had opened in the side of the corridor. "No!" yelled Aragorn, but before he could stop it, the door swung shut as silently as it had opened, and the wall appeared perfectly solid once more. "Brisinger!" he shouted, and his sword erupted in flame. He placed the tip against the wall and attempted to push it through the stone, intending to cut open the door. The stone was thick, though, and slow to melt, and he soon realized it would take far more energy than he was willing to sacrifice. Then Arya appeared beside him, and she placed a hand where the door was and murmured, "Ladrin, open." The door remained stubbornly closed, but Aragorn was embarrassed he had not thought to try that first. Their pursuers were so close by now that he and Arya had no choice but to turn and face them. Aragorn wanted to cast the spell he had invented, but the corridor was only wide enough for 2 men to approach at a time. He would not be able to kill the rest, as they were hidden from sight. Better to keep the spell a secret, he decided, and save it for when he could wipe out most of the warriors at once. He and Arya beheaded the 2 lead men, then attacked the next pair of warriors as they stepped over the bodies. In quick succession, they killed 6 more men, but there seemed to be no end of them. "Through here!" shouted Wirden. "Stenner Slaughter!" exclaimed Arya, and all along the corridor, up to a few yards from where she stood, the stones in the walls exploded into the passageway. The hail of sharp fragments caused the black-clad men to cower and falter, and more than one fell to the floor, crippled. Together, Aragorn and Arya turned to follow Wirden, who was running toward the opening at the end of the corridor. The elf was only 30 feet away from it, then 10, then 5. And then a thicket of amethyst spikes shot out of holes in the floor and the ceiling, catching Wirden between them. The elf seemed to float in the middle of the corridor, the spikes less than an inch away from his skin as his wards repelled the crystal thorns. Then a crackling discharge of energy ran the length of each spike, and the needle-sharp tips flared painfully bright, and with an unpleasant crunch, they slid home. Wirden screamed and thrashed, and then his weirlight went out, and he moved no more. Aragorn stared with disbelief as he stumbled to a stop before the spikes. For all his experience in battle, he had never before been present at the death of an elf. Wirden and Blodgarm and the rest of their cohort were so accomplished, Aragorn had believed that the only way they were likely to die was while fighting either Galbatorix or Murtagh. Arya appeared equally stunned. She rallied quickly, however. "Aragorn," she said in an urgent voice, "cut us a path with Brisinga." He understood. His sword, unlike hers, would be impervious to whatever evil magic the spikes contained. He drew back his arm and swung as hard as he could. A half dozen of the spikes shattered beneath Brisinga's adamantine edge. The amethyst emitted a bell-like tone as it broke, and when the shards struck the ground, they tinkled like ice. Aragorn kept to the right of the corridor, making sure not to hit the blood-streaked spikes that held up Wirden's body. Again and again he swung, hacking his way through the glittering thicket. With every blow, he sent pieces of amethyst flying through the air. One sliced his left cheek and he winced, surprised and concerned that his wards had failed. The jagged remnants of the broken spikes forced him to move carefully. The stumps below could easily pierce his boots, while the ones above threatened to cut him about the head and neck. Still, he managed to navigate to the far side of the thicket with only a small gash on his right calf, which stung whenever he put his weight on the leg. The black-clad warriors nearly caught up with him as he helped Arya past the last few rows of spikes. Once she was free, they rushed through the opening and into the purplish light. Aragorn, with every intention of then turning around and confronting their attackers head-on and killing every last one of them in retaliation for Wirden's death. On the other side of the opening was a dark, heavily built chamber that reminded Aragorn of the caves under Trondheim. A huge, circular pattern of inlaid stone, marble and chalcedony and polished hematite occupied the center of the floor. Around the edge of the pattern disc stood rough, fist-sized chunks of amethyst set within silver collars. Each piece of the purple rock glowed softly, the source of the light they had seen from the corridor. Across the disc, against the far wall, was a large black altar draped with a gold and crimson cloth. Pillars and candelabra flanked the altar, with a closed door on each side. All this Aragorn saw as he barreled into the room, in the brief instant before he realized that his momentum was going to carry him through the ring of amethysts and onto the disc. He tried to stop himself, tried to turn aside, but he was moving too fast. Desperate, he did the one thing he could. He jumped toward the altar, hoping he could clear the disc in a single bound. As he sailed over the nearest of the amethyst stones, his last feeling was regret, and his last thought was of Saphira. To feed a god. The first thing Aragorn noticed was the difference in the colours. The stone blocks in the ceiling appeared richer than before. Details that had been obscure now seemed sharp and vivid, while others that had been prominent were subdued. Below him, the sumptuous nature of the patterned disc was even more apparent. It took him a moment to understand the reason for the change. Arya's red weirlight no longer illuminated the chamber. Instead, what light there was came from the muted glow of the crystals and the lit candles in the candelabra. Only then did he realize that something was crammed into his mouth, stretching his jaw painfully wide. and that he was hanging by his wrists from a chain mounted in the ceiling. He tried to move and found that his ankles were shackled and secured to a metal loop in the floor. As he twisted in place, he saw Arya next to him, trussed and suspended in the same manner. Like him, she was gagged with a ball of cloth in her mouth and a rag tied around her head to hold it in place. She was already awake and watching him, and he saw she was relieved at his return to consciousness. "Why hasn't she escaped already?" he wondered. Then, what happened? His thoughts felt thick and slow, as if he were drunk with exhaustion. He looked down and saw that he had been stripped of his weapons and armour. He was clad only in his leggings. The belt of Beloth the Wise was gone, as was the necklace the dwarves had given him that prevented anyone from scrying him. Looking up, he saw that the elf ring Arran was missing from his hand. A touch of panic gripped him. Then he reassured himself with the knowledge that he was not helpless, not so long as he could work magic. Because of the cloth in his mouth, he would have to cast a spell without uttering it aloud, which was somewhat more dangerous than the normal method, for if his thoughts strayed during the process, he might accidentally select the wrong words, but not so dangerous as casting a spell without any use of the ancient language at all, which was perilous indeed. In any event, it would take only a small amount of energy for him to free himself, and he was confident he could do it without too much trouble. He closed his eyes and gathered his resources in preparation. As he did, he heard Arya rattling her chain and making muffled noises. Glancing over, he saw her shaking her head at him. He raised his eyebrows in a wordless inquiry. "What is it?" But she was unable to do anything more than grunt and continue to shake her head. Frustrated, Aragorn cautiously pushed out his mind toward her, alert for the slightest hint of intrusion from anyone else. But to his alarm, he felt only a soft, indistinct pressure surrounding him, as if bales of wool were packed around his mind. Panic began to well up inside of him again, despite his efforts to control it. He was not drugged, of that he was sure. But he did not know what else besides a drug could prevent him from touching Arya's mind. If it was magic, it was magic unlike any he was familiar with. He and Arya stared at each other for a moment. Then a stir of motion drew Aragorn's eye upward, and he saw lines of blood running down her forearms, from where the manacles around her wrists had scraped away the skin. Rage engulfed him. He grabbed the chain above him and yanked on it as hard as he could. The links held, but he refused to give up. In a frenzy of anger, he pulled on it again and again, without regard for the harm he was causing himself. At last he stopped and hung limply, while hot blood dripped from his wrists onto the back of his neck and shoulders. Determined to escape, he delved into the flow of energy within his body, and directing the spell at his shackles, he mentally shouted, "Kverst marmer du hilders edtha, marfrema ne thon eka threya." He screamed into his gag as every nerve in his body seared with pain. Unable to maintain his concentration, he lost his grip on the spell, and the enchantment ended. The pain vanished at once, but it left him devoid of breath, with his heart pounding as heavily as if he had just jumped off a cliff. The experience was similar to the seizures he had suffered before the dragons healed the scar on his back during the Agaiti Blodron. As he slowly recovered, he saw Arya gazing at him with a concerned expression. She must have tried a spell herself. Then, how could this have happened? The two of them, bound and helpless, Weird and dead, the herbalist captured or slain, and Solombum most likely lying hurt somewhere in the underground maze, if the black-clad warriors had not already killed the Weircat. Aragorn could not understand it. He, Arya, Wirden, and Angela had been as capable and dangerous a group as any in Alagazia. And yet they had failed, and he and Arya were at the mercy of their enemies. "If we can't escape..." He shied away from the thought. It did not bear dwelling on. More than anything, he wished he could contact Saphira, if only to be assured that she was still safe and to take comfort in her companionship. Though Arya was with him, he felt incredibly alone, and that unnerved him most of all. Despite the agony in his wrists, he resumed pulling on the chain, convinced that if he just kept at it long enough, he could work it loose from the ceiling. He tried twisting it, thinking it would be easier to break that way, but the fetters around his ankles kept him from turning very far to either side. The sores on his wrist eventually forced him to stop. They burned like fire, and he was afraid he might end up cutting into muscle if he continued. Also, he worried he might lose too much blood, as the sores were already bleeding heavily, and he did not know how long he and Arya would have to hang there waiting. It was impossible to tell what time it was, but he guessed that they had been captives for only a few hours at the most, given that he did not feel the need to eat, drink, or relieve himself. That would change, though, and then their discomfort would only increase. The pain in Aragorn's wrists made every minute seem unbearably long. Occasionally, he and Arya would stare at each other and try to communicate, but their efforts always failed. Twice, his sores crusted over enough that he risked yanking on the chain again, but to no avail. For the most part, he and Arya endured. Then, when Aragorn had begun to wonder if anyone was ever going to come, he heard the clang of iron bells from somewhere in the tunnels and passageways, and the doors on either side of the black altar swung open on silent hinges. Aragorn's muscles tensed in anticipation. He fixed his eyes on the openings, as did Arya. A seemingly endless minute passed. With a brash, jarring toll, the bells sounded again, filling the chamber with a swarm of angry echoes. Through the doorways marched three novitiates, young men garbed in golden cloth, each carrying a metal frame hung with bells. Behind them followed 24 men and women, not one of whom possessed a full set of limbs. Unlike their predecessors, the cripples wore robes of dark leather, tailored to match their individual infirmities. And last of all, six oiled slaves carried in a bier, upon which, propped upright, rested an armless, legless, toothless, seemingly sexless figure, the High Priest of Helgrind. From its head rose a 3-foot-high crest, which only made the creature appear even more misshapen. The priests and novitiates positioned themselves around the edge of the patterned disc on the floor, while the slaves gently lowered the bier onto the altar at the head of the room. Then the three perfect, handsome young men shook the bells once more, creating a discordant crash, and the leather-clad priests chanted a short phrase so quickly that Aragorn was not sure what they said, though it had the sound of ritual. Amongst the crush of words, he caught the names of the three peaks of Helgrind: Gorm, Ilda, and Fel Angvara. The High Priest gazed at him and Arya with eyes like chips of obsidian.
"Welcome to the Halls of Tosk," it said, and its withered mouth distorted the words. "Twice now you have invaded our inner sanctums, Dragonrider. You shall not have the opportunity to do so again. Galvatorix would have us spare your lives and send you to Urabane. He believes he can force you to serve him. He dreams of resurrecting the riders and restoring the race of dragons. I say his dreams are folly. You are too dangerous, and we do not want to see the dragons resurgent. It is commonly believed that we worship Helgrind. That is a lie we tell others to conceal the true nature of our religion. It is not Helgrind that we revere. It is the Old Ones who made their lair within, and to whom we sacrificed our flesh and blood. The Razak are our gods, Dragon Rider. The Razak and the Leather Blacker."
Dread crept through Aragorn like a sickness. The High Priest spat at him, and spittle drooled from its slack lower lip.
"There is no torture horrible enough for your crime, Rider. You killed our gods, you and that accursed dragon of yours. For that, you must die."
Aragorn struggled against his bonds, and tried to shout through his gag. If he could talk, he could stall for time by telling them what the Razak's last words had been, perhaps, or by threatening them with Saphira's vengeance. But their captors showed no inclination to remove his gag. In a hideous gesture, the High Priest smiled, showing its grey gums.
"You will never escape, Ryder. The crystals here were enchanted to trap any who might try to desecrate our temple or steal our treasures, even one such as you. Nor is there anyone to rescue you. Two of your companions are dead, yes, even that meddlesome witch, and Murtag knows nothing of your presence here. Today is the day of your doom, Aragorn, Shade Slayer."
Then the High Priest tilted back its head and uttered a gruesome, gurgling whistle. From the dark doorway to the left of the altar, there appeared four bare-chested slaves. On their shoulders they bore a platform with two large, shallow, cup-like protrusions in the middle. Within the protrusions lay a pair of oval objects, each about a foot and a half long and half a foot thick. The objects were blue-black and pitted like sandstone. Time seemed to slow for Aragorn.
"They can't be," he thought.
Saphira's egg had been smooth, however, and veined like marble. Whatever these objects were, they were not dragon eggs. The alternatives frightened him even more.
"Since you killed the old ones," said the High Priest, "it is only fitting that you provide the food for their rebirth. You do not deserve such a great honour, but it will please the old ones, and in all things we strive to satisfy their desires. We are their faithful servants, and they our masters, cruel and implacable. The three-faced god, the hunters of men, the eaters of flesh, and the drinkers of blood. To them we offer up our bodies in hope of revelation into the mysteries of this life, and in hope of absolution for our transgressions. As Tosk wrote, so shall it be."
In unison, the leather-clad priests repeated,
"As Tosk wrote, so shall it be."
The High Priest nodded.
"The old ones have always nested on Hellgrind, but in the time of my grandfather's father, Galbatorix stole their eggs and killed their young, and he forced them to swear fealty to him, lest he eradicate their line entirely. He hollowed out the caves and tunnels they have used ever since. And to us, to their devoted acolytes, he gave charge of their eggs, to watch and to hold and to care for until they were needed. This we have done, and none may fault us for our service. But we pray that some day Galbatorix shall be overthrown, for none should bind the old ones to their will. It is an abomination."
The deformed creature licked its lips, and to his disgust, Aragorn saw that part of its tongue was missing, carved away by a knife.
"You too, we wish gone, Ryder. The dragons were the old ones' greatest enemies. Without them, and without Galbatorix, there would be no one to stop the old ones from feasting where and how they will."
As the High Priest spoke, the four slaves bearing the platform walked forth and carefully lowered it from their shoulders onto the patterned disc, setting it down several paces in front of Aragorn and Arya. Once they finished, they bowed their heads and retreated through the doorway from which they had come.
"Who could ask for anything more than to feed a god with the marrow of their bones?" asked the High Priest. "Rejoice, both of you, for today you received the blessing of the old ones, and by your sacrifice the record of your sins shall be washed clean, and you shall enter the afterlife as pure as a newly born child." Then the high priest and its followers raised their faces toward the ceiling and began to intone a strange, oddly accented song that Aragorn had trouble understanding. He wondered if it was in the dialect of Tosk. At times he heard what he thought were words in the ancient language, mangled and misused, but still the ancient language. When the grotesque congregation finished, ending with another chorus of, "As Tosk wrote, so shall it be," the three novitiates shook the bells in an ecstasy of religious fervour, and the resulting clamour seemed loud enough to bring down the ceiling. Still shaking the bells, the novitiates filed out of the room. The 24 lesser priests departed next, and then, bringing up the rear of the procession, their limbless master, transported upon its bier by the 6 oiled slaves. The door closed behind them with an ominous boom, and Aragorn heard a heavy bar fall into place on the other side. He turned to look at Arya. The expression in her eyes was that of despair, and he knew she had no more idea of how to escape than he did. He gazed upward again and pulled on the chain that held him, using as much of his strength as he dared. The sores on his wrists again tore open, and they sprinkled him with drops of blood. In front of them, the leftmost egg began to rock back and forth ever so slightly, and from it came a faint tapping, like the rapping of a tiny hammer. A profound sense of horror suffused Aragorn. Of all the ways he could imagine dying, being eaten alive by a Razak was by far the worst. He yanked on the chain with renewed determination, biting his gag to help him withstand the agony in his arms. The resulting pain caused his vision to flicker. Next to him, Arya thrashed and twisted as well, both of them fighting in deadly silence to free themselves. And still the tap, tap, tapping continued on the blue-black shell. "It's no use," Aragorn realized. The chain would not give. As soon as he accepted the fact, it became obvious that it would be impossible to avoid being hurt far worse than he already was. The only question was whether his injuries would be forced upon him, or whether they would be of his own choosing. "If nothing else, I have to save Arya." He studied the iron bands around his wrists. "If I can break my thumbs, I might be able to pull my hands out. Then at least I could fight. Maybe I could grab a piece of the Razak shell and use it as a knife." With something to cut, he could free his legs as well, though the thought was so terrifying he ignored it for the time being. "All I would have to do is crawl out of the circle of stones. He would be able to use magic then, and he could stop the pain and the bleeding. What he was considering would only take a few minutes, but he knew they would be the longest minutes of his life." He drew in a breath in preparation. "Left hand first." Before he could start, Arya screamed. He spun toward her and uttered a wordless exclamation as he saw the mangled fingers of her right hand. Her skin was pushed up like a glove toward her nails, and the white of bone showed amid crimson muscle. Arya sagged and appeared to lose consciousness for a moment. Then she recovered and pulled on her arm once more. Aragorn cried out with her as her hand slid through the metal cuff, tearing off skin and flesh. Her arm fell to her side, hiding the hand from his sight, though he could see the blood splattering on the floor by her feet. Tears blurred his eyes, and he shouted her name into his gag, but she seemed not to hear him. As she braced herself to repeat the process, the door to the right of the altar opened, and one of the golden-robed novitiates slipped into the chamber. Seeing him, Arya hesitated, though Aragorn knew she would pull her other hand out of the manacle at the slightest hint of danger. The young man looked askance at Arya, then cautiously made his way to the center of the patterned disc, casting apprehensive glances at the egg that was rocking back and forth.
The youth was slight, with large eyes and delicate features. It seemed obvious to Aragorn that he had been chosen for his position because of his appearance.
"Here," whispered the youth, "I brought these."
From within his robes he produced a file, a chisel, and a wooden mallet.
"If I help, you have to take me with you. I can't stand it here any longer. I hate it, it's horrible. Promise you'll take me with you."
Even before he finished speaking, Aragorn was nodding his assent. As the young man started toward him, though, Aragorn growled and motioned with his head in Arya's direction. It took a few seconds before the novitiate understood.
"Oh, yes," murmured the young man, and went over to Arya instead.
Aragorn ground his teeth through the gag in anger over the youth's slowness. The harsh scrape of the file soon drowned out the tapping from within the wobbling egg. Aragorn watched as best he could while their would-be rescuer soared on a section of chain above Arya's left hand.
"Keep the file on the same link, you fool!"
Aragorn raged. The novitiate looked as if he had never used a file before, and Aragorn doubted that the youth had the strength or endurance to cut through even a small amount of metal. Arya hung limply while the novitiate worked, her long hair covering her face. She trembled at regular intervals, and the fall of blood from her ruined hand continued unabated. To Aragorn's dismay, the file did not seem to be leaving a mark on the chain. Whatever magics protected the metal, they were too strong for something as simple as a file to overcome. The novitiate huffed, appearing petulant at his lack of progress. He paused and wiped his brow, then frowning, attacked the chain once again, elbows flailing, chest heaving, the sleeves of his robe flapping wildly.
"Don't you realize it's not going to work?" thought Aragorn. "Try the chisel on the shackles around her ankles instead."
The young man continued as he was. A sharp crack echoed through the chamber, and Aragorn saw a thin fissure appear at the top of the dark, pitted egg. The fissure lengthened, and a web of hairline fractures spread outward from it. Then the second egg began to wobble as well, and from it came another tap-tap-tapping, which joined with the first to form a maddening rhythm. The novitiate went pale, then dropped the file, and backed away from Arya, shaking his head.
I'm sorry, it's too late."
His face crumpled, and tears rolled from his eyes.
"I'm sorry."
Aragorn's alarm increased as the young man pulled a dagger from within his robes.
"There's nothing else I can do," he said, almost as if he were speaking to himself. "Nothing else,"
he sniffed and moved toward Aragorn.
"It's for the best."
As the young man stepped forward, Aragorn wrenched at his bonds, trying to pull one of his hands out of the manacles. The iron cuffs were too tight, however, and all he succeeded in doing was scraping more skin off his wrists.
"I'm sorry,"
whispered the young man, as he stopped in front of Aragorn and drew back the dagger.
"No!"
Aragorn shouted in his mind. A chunk of glittering amethyst hurtled out of the tunnel that had brought Aragorn and Arya to the chamber. It struck the novitiate in the back of the head, and he fell against Aragorn. Aragorn flinched as he felt the edge of the dagger slide across his ribs. Then the young man tumbled to the floor and lay there, unconscious. From within the depths of the tunnel emerged a small, limping figure. Aragorn stared, and as the figure moved into the light, he saw that it was none other than Solemnbum. Relief swept through Aragorn. The weercat was in his human form, and he was naked except for a ragged loincloth that looked as if it had been torn from the clothes of their attackers. His spiky black hair stood nearly on end, and a feral snarl disfigured his lips. Several cuts covered his forearms, his left ear hung drooping from the side of his head, and a strip of skin was missing from his scalp. He carried a blood-smeared knife. And following a few paces behind the weercat was the herbalist, Angela.